From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll learn how fake electors attempted to overturn the 2020 election and look at a new lawsuit challenging the scheme. Then we'll learn how childbearing people of color could be affected if Roe v. Wade is overturned.
We don't need additional barriers to something as important for our literal lives as the need to be able to access health care. And for many women of color and birthing people, this decision will exacerbate an existing problem.
We'll learn about Milwaukee's largest hip-hop collection.
We don't have a hip-hop museum in Milwaukee, so I'm looking forward to bringing people into this space so we can create a larger museum for positive interactions in Milwaukee.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson has been implicated in the attempt to overthrow our duly elected government by putting forward a slate of fake electors to overturn the legal votes of millions of Wisconsinites. That's according to yesterday's congressional hearing, which gave evidence that Senator Johnson's chief of staff contacted Vice President Mike Pence, attempting to hand-deliver the fake electors' fraudulent documents to Pence in time for the vote to certify the election on January 6, 2021. Johnson gave a conflicting statement on the incident, both claiming he was aware his staff attempted to deliver the falsified documents, while also claiming he was unaware of the situation and not involved. These fake electors were a core part of the attempt to overthrow the government and reinstate former President Donald Trump, despite his losing the election to President Joe Biden. But is it illegal to overturn an election and effectively revoke our ability as voters to choose our political leaders? That question is at the heart of a new lawsuit from Law Forward, challenging the legality of this scheme. Jeff Mandel is the lead counsel and president of Law Forward. He joins me now to talk about this. Jeff, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So in Wisconsin, as in other states, there was this kind of, what seems to me from the outside looking in, a plot to overthrow the election. I'm not sure that there's really another way to say that. People in the state of Wisconsin, fake electors cast ballots in support of Donald Trump, who, of course, did not win the 2020 election in Wisconsin. Just to take a step back here, how did this plot begin?
Sure. So let's take a step back even before that and think a little bit about our sort of schoolhouse rock civics. We all talk about, who are you going to vote for president? Right? Were you voting for Biden or were you voting for Trump? But if you look at the Wisconsin statutes and you think about how the Constitution works, you're really not voting for an individual candidate. You're voting for a slate of electors to participate in the Electoral College. The Electoral College, which is comprised of representatives from each of our states, is how we choose the President of the United States and the Vice President. We don't list those electors on the ballot anymore, but every candidate who appears on the ballot has provided the Wisconsin Elections Commission in advance of the election a list of who the 10 electors who will support them are if they were to win the popular vote in the state of Wisconsin. Their slate of 10 electors would get to participate in the Electoral College. And so what we're talking about here when we talk about fraudulent electors is we're talking about the fact the Biden-Harris campaign won the popular election in the state of Wisconsin. We had record turnout. Almost 3.3 million Wisconsinites voted. Those votes were checked at the ward level, then rechecked at the municipal level, checked again at the county level, and finally went through a check at the state level. There was also a recount of Dane and Milwaukee counties, and there was litigation in state and federal courts, all of which confirmed this outcome. And nonetheless, the 10 individuals who had signed on to be electors, if the Trump-Pence campaign won, took it upon themselves to meet at the Wisconsin Capitol as if Trump and Pence had won, and to fill out paperwork and send that paperwork to Congress and to the National Archives, to a federal court, and to the Wisconsin Secretary of State, as if they were the valid electors. And that paperwork even says they were. It says they were the duly elected and qualified electors for the state of Wisconsin. So Wisconsin has this role at the Electoral College in helping with the other states to choose the next president. And these 10 individuals tried to hijack that role in a way that was completely illegal.
Now, to me, that does on its face seem completely illegal. I mean, as you mentioned, there were a lot of different ways in which this particular election was checked, but also in many ways, it was a fairly routine election, aside from record turnout and the fact that there was a fair amount of mail-in voting, but we have had mail-in voting in previous elections. This isn't something new in the state of Wisconsin. So I'm a little unclear as to why it wouldn't be looked at as illegal, because it seems like the moment these people wrote down their name saying they were duly elected, that was a lie. That was illegal. What is the argument that it isn't?
Well, it's an understandable confusion, Joy. Here's really the crux of the matter. What these folks did was so beyond the pale. It was so unprecedented. It was such a departure from anything that anyone had ever imagined in our democracy before. We've been electing presidents in this country for 230 years. And this was such a step beyond what anyone had ever imagined that there isn't a law that specifically says you can't do this. And that's where the debate comes in. Now, we think that it's clearly illegal. We have called these people fraudulent electors because we think that when they signed something that said, we are the duly elected and qualified electors for the state of Wisconsin, even though they knew that to be false, that seems like fraud. But traditionally, as a legal matter, to defraud someone, you need them to actually believe you. And nobody who got to make decisions ultimately believed these people. Congress did not accept these fraudulent electors' paperwork. It did accept the paperwork from the valid electors. And because there's no specific law against what they did, because no one had ever thought of it before, and because no one relied on their lies, it took us quite a bit of work and quite a bit of time to come up with some theories about how existing law could respond to this particular conduct.
It does seem a little odd that we don't have a law that specifically says you can't defy the will of voters and just elect whoever you want as the Electoral College. That seems, I mean, it's obviously anti-democratic, but it also seems thereby like there would be some kind of rule. And I think one of the things that really trips people up in this situation is when you think about, you know, an attempted overthrow of the government, you think of the kinds of scenes that you saw on January 6th, the kinds of scenes that you see in countries around the world where there are violent mobs attempting to murder public officials, physically taking over government institutions. And what we're talking about with these fake electors, it's really paperwork. How do you contextualize, I guess, the intent of these actions?
There's no doubt that the intent was essentially to overthrow our system of a peaceful transition of power and to keep President Trump in office, though he had not been reelected by the people. And in fact, if you listen to some of the testimony that we're hearing at the January 6th committee or look at some of the emails and documents that they're revealing, some of the lawyers and other operatives who were most behind this fraudulent elector scheme were very upset about the rioting on January 6th because they felt like it was going to get in the way. It was going to prevent them from succeeding in what they thought they could do in this very genteel way that people wouldn't notice. But there's no doubt that the intent was fundamentally the same. And I would also note the papers that the fraudulent electors in Wisconsin and the six other states submitted to Congress were the necessary foundation for those riots on January 6th. As those rioters and those insurrectionists swarmed the halls of the Capitol, chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," or urging Mike Pence to stand up and do what they saw as the right thing, we have to ask ourselves, what is it that they wanted from Vice President Pence? What they wanted was for him to count the fake elector certificates instead of the real ones. If there had not been any fake elector certificates, there isn't anything they could have been pressuring him to do. There isn't anything they could have been threatening him if he refused to do. So it really is all tied together. You know, sort of the fraudulent electors and the January 6th insurrection are flip sides of the same coin. And it's terrifying whether you think about it either way, whether you think about those images on January 6th and an outburst of political violence in this country like we haven't seen in quite a long time, or if you think about the idea that there were people who thought because this was just paperwork, they could slide it through and nobody would notice or nobody would get upset.
This is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers, and I'm speaking with Jeff Mandel from Law Forward. It should be noted that one of the fake electors, Bob Spindell Jr., he actually remains a member of the Wisconsin Election Commission. That's the commission charged with overseeing elections in the state of Wisconsin. So I want to go back into the lawsuit itself. What are you alleging happened here, and what are the consequences if the lawsuit succeeds?
Sure. So this is the lawsuit we're talking about is a civil lawsuit that we filed last month in Dane County Circuit Court here in Wisconsin that uses some longstanding legal doctrines and says, you know, what these people did is inconsistent with them. So the lawsuit is about 50 pages because it very carefully and step by step walks through exactly what happened and how the fraudulent electors did what they did. To the extent that we know now, I do expect that this week's January 6th committee hearings and that the process of discovery in our lawsuit will allow us to learn a lot more and possibly bring in additional folks who are responsible for what happened here.
So what does a remedy look like? What are the consequences of the lawsuit if you succeed? Do we continue to have people possibly overseeing our elections or running our government who attempted to overthrow it?
Well, the whole point here is accountability, is making sure that people who did this face accountability for the decisions they made and the actions they took. And so we're seeking a number of remedies. One of them is we want a clear and emphatic statement from the courts that this is not acceptable, that this is a violation of Wisconsin law. Because as you said, this idea is so axiomatic that no one's ever taken the time to enshrine it in statute or anything like that. And so we want a court to make that clear. And also to use this as a way of shining light for the public on what did happen. But we want more than that. We want these 10 individuals to be prohibited from ever participating in Wisconsin's Electoral College again. Having tried to defraud it and hijack the state's participation once, they shouldn't have the opportunity to do so in the future or to participate in any way in that in the future. We want the court to order them that whatever order the court sets out saying that this is wrong and that these folks were not duly qualified and elected Electoral College members for the state of Wisconsin, we want them to have to send that to all of the government officials to whom they sent their fraudulent papers, so that there is no doubt. And in the future, when historians and others are looking back, no one could look at this Wisconsin precedent and say, oh, maybe that was okay, or maybe there was some question. We want that record to be corrected. And then we've also asked the court, because the conduct here was so egregious and so deleterious to democracy, we have asked the court to award punitive damages against each of the defendants. The purpose here isn't the money, though. The purpose here is the accountability and the deterrence and coming up with everything that we can to make sure that that no one ever does anything like this again. The other part of your question I thought was really interesting, Joy, is about the fact that some of these individuals continue to hold significant positions in our civic life. As you noted, Mr. Spindell continues to be a commissioner on the Elections Commission, and he was reappointed by Senate Majority Leader LeMahieu even after it had become clear what the fraudulent electors did and his participation in that. One of the fraudulent electors, Bill Feehan, is on the steering committee for Rebecca Clayfish's gubernatorial campaign. Another fraudulent elector, Andrew Hitt, who at the time that the fraudulent electors met was the chair of the Republican Party of Wisconsin, is now running the campaign of one of the candidates to be attorney general. So you've got someone who wants to be the chief law enforcement officer for the state of Wisconsin and has chosen to run his campaign, someone who has openly and notoriously and unapologetically done something that really is illegal and almost certainly criminal. it is my contention that there shouldn't be room for these folks in our civic life, that these folks have, by their own decisions and actions, driven themselves out of civic life. But that's something I think we're unlikely to get from a court. I think that's something we're going to need to see come from public demands and the ordinary system of politics. We need the public, as they understand what actually happened when the fraudulent electors met, just to say that they will not accept these folks as potential leaders or as senior advisors to our leaders, or playing a part in Wisconsin's public life, because we can disagree about politics, we can disagree about policy, but fundamentally, we all need to agree on the basic ground rules, which is that we are governed by elections and the candidate who gets the most votes wins.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me, Julia. It was a pleasure.
Jeff Mandel is the lead counsel and president of Law Forward. You can find all of our coverage of the January 6th committee hearings at WUWM.com. We reached out to the attorney representing the fake electors to comment on the lawsuit, but have not yet received a response. We'll likely learn next week if the Roe v. Wade ruling that legalized abortion access in the U.S. will be overturned. In May, a leaked U.S. Supreme Court draft opinion showed the court may vote to strike down the law, but the final decision hasn't been announced. Experts say if Roe is overturned, childbearing people of color and Black people especially will bear the brunt of the impact. Black women experience the highest levels of unintended pregnancies and are 3 times more likely than white women to seek abortion services. Hispanic women are 2 times more likely to experience an unintended pregnancy than white women. That's according to the Guttmacher Institute, a research and policy organization which backs reproductive rights. Factors like racism, unequal access to family planning services, distrust of the medical system, and economic disadvantages create disparate conditions for people of color seeking health care. Sarah Noble is the former executive director of the Reproductive Justice Collective in Milwaukee. She joins WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell to share more about the potential impact if Roe v. Wade is overturned.
It's important that we note abortion is health care, and due to many factors, namely racism, we're already not receiving the health care that we need. So our current conditions are not what they should be. So we don't need additional barriers to something as important for our literal lives as, you know, the need to be able to access health care. And for many women of color and birthing people, this decision will exacerbate an existing problem of accessing an abortion. So added to the barrier of not being able to afford, for example, an abortion, will be the cost of and the access to transportation, for some finding childcare, possibly paying for overnight accommodations if, you know, folks have to travel and wait out some time before they can receive abortion care, getting time off work. And of course, you know, loss of pay for people who may even be able to get the time off. So I don't think, you know, it requires us to have to think hard and long about all of the other conditions that we're already experiencing, from, you know, issues around poverty and lack of good housing and lack of access to health care, as I said just a second ago, to, you know, high rates of unemployment, access to, you know, quality education. You know, the list goes on and on. We don't need more. We already have enough, and really should not even be spending our time in this fight.
So as someone who's worked in reproductive justice for more than 20 years, did you see this threat to overturning Roe coming? If so, how?
Well, Ken, that's a really great question, and I really would like to respond to your question by first saying that I'm among many reproductive justice leaders across the country, and for us, this is not new at all. This has been coming, and, you know, obviously it has a huge amount of press now and is getting a lot of attention, but it is not new. And I'll quickly just say something about what reproductive justice is. It's reproductive health plus reproductive rights plus social justice. It's the human right to maintain personal bodily autonomy and the human right to have children, to not have children. And this piece is so important, you know, just as important as all of the rest of what it means to have reproductive justice, and that is to parent the children we have in safe and sustainable communities. It looks at the intersections of discrimination in social, political, and economic systems, and it sheds light on the barriers that those systems produce. And its leaders, like me and so many around this country, fight against those barriers. And it's also important to say that it's about the protection of human rights based on our intersectional identities, which includes queer and trans people. But reproductive justice leaders, as I was speaking to at the top, have really been anticipating this for many years. And there were some anti-abortion billboards, for example. There was a campaign that happened in 2010, very specifically targeting women of color. That was one of the signals that this day was coming. Some had words like endangered species written across the faces of black babies, and others read like the most dangerous place for an African American or a Latino is in the womb. So this is part of a long game strategy. So they started out with these campaigns to vilify women of color. They used an issue as sensitive as abortion to create division, and then to paint, you know, women of color generally as puppets, you know, who have no authority over our lives. But we knew then what we know now, and that is we have to continue our work to demand our human rights be honored, including, you know, authority over our own bodies and, you know, being able to receive abortion care with dignity, with respect, and without shame or fear. So this is connected to too many other things that I don't think are really like in the forefront or present in people's minds. And we really, really need to make sure that we're paying full attention to this fact, and that overturning Roe is just the beginning. The implications of what we're experiencing are far beyond abortion. So other rights like, you know, the right to contraception, gay marriage, voting rights, and many others are also in jeopardy. This is, again, one of many strategies with one common goal in mind. And that's control, not care. That's not what this is about here. So conservative groups and lawmakers who oppose abortion really don't have any interest, as we have noted, addressing the various oppressions we talked about at the beginning that have a detrimental impact on the people's lives. And the reality is that they don't really care about us not continuing the pregnancy or about the children that we already have. It's evidenced by all the conditions that we name that, you know, come for the people who are really most vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for explaining how this goes beyond abortions, but really other basic human rights could be in jeopardy as well. But getting back to abortions, for people who want to lend their support to abortion rights in Wisconsin, what advice do you have for them for how they can do that?
Yes. Well, you know, it's important that we not be distracted from the human rights argument that says that bodily autonomy, which, you know, I should have said earlier, really is about being in control of what happens to our bodies, including the decision to continue or terminate a pregnancy, really rests with the pregnant person at all times and in all circumstances. We want to not have this right, like any other right, be conditional. That part is really important. And as people of color, we know all too well that there are rights that do not apply to us. Even though the rights exist, they don't apply to us. And when rights don't apply to all individuals at all times, they are not a right. And so it's important for us, as we're doing the work, to hold that as incredibly important for every aspect of our work, for all the things that we're doing. because otherwise it sets up our rights to, as I said, to be conditional and making them an easy mark for eroding them and ultimately having them taken away by people who believe that they and only they can determine who should or should not have those rights. And, you know, currently in Wisconsin, so it's important to note that abortion is legal. And it is also important for people to know that we have a law on the books that bans abortion at any stage of pregnancy without exception. There is an opportunity for people, in addition to all of the various actions, you know, people will be, you know, just paying attention. They will know that there are a lot of actions taking place across Wisconsin and across the country. And here in our state, people have the opportunity to call the Wisconsin legislature and tell the individual legislators what we want to happen, which is to repeal that 172-year-old ban on abortion. They can do the right thing, and it's on us to demand.
Sarah Noble is the former executive director of the Reproductive Justice Collective. She spoke with WUWM race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell. Coming up later in the show, we'll share some safety tips to protect yourself from tick bites and how to recognize the early signs of Lyme disease. But first, we'll visit Antonia's 365 Hip Hop Museum in Milwaukee and learn about her mission to catalyze social change. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. One of the largest hip-hop collections in Wisconsin is right here in Milwaukee. Antonia Anderson has been a lifelong fan of hip-hop and started collecting hip-hop memorabilia in 2020. Now, Anderson has filled her apartment walls with records, listening stations, and dolls of hip-hop artists. She named her collection Antonia's 365 Hip-Hop Museum. From 1930s gospel to early 2000s hip-hop, the collection features national and local artists. Lake Effect's Mallory Chang chats with Anderson at the museum.
So we're at the museum right now, and you've turned your apartment into a literal 365 degrees hip-hop museum. And there's so many different hip-hop artists. There's different records on the wall. You got a boombox on the corner, and there's a bunch of cases of records that people can flip through. Why did you want to open up a hip-hop museum here in Milwaukee? What was your motivator to do that?
Before COVID, I was going out in the community doing pop-ups at different events like True School, COA, wherever I could find events. And when the city was shut down, I had my things in boxes, and I just decided to put it all out in my home, and I was just going to go for there because I didn't want my stuff just sitting in boxes. And as I started putting it up on the wall, that's when I got the idea of the actual museum. My collection, it really goes back, I want to say, to the 1930s, and it really went from spiritual to jazz to R&B and then hip-hop. So I would say from like 1932 to the 2000s. I pretty much started collecting records and cassettes like early on in 2012. But during the pandemic, I really started collecting more hip-hop items. My motivation was to encourage the students and the youth to find a way to express themselves through hip-hop, and also it helps them with their critical thinking skills.
You mentioned that you wanted to make it for the young people that who come into the space. What is your goal when students walk in and see the 365 Hip-Hop Museum?
I want them to be comfortable. You know, as soon as they come in, it's a lot of exciting things for them to see. I currently work at Milwaukee Marshall High School and also work in the evening at COA after school program. So I go from the 9th through the 12th graders, and then I go work with the K-3, K-4, and the 1st and 2nd graders. I have a lot of on-hand interaction things like the record player. I want to talk to them about the 8-track, and I also have like VCR, a lot of action figures and books, a lot of things that they can just go through and get that feel of the original hip hop that really, you know, started back in the 1970s on up into 2000s.
Why did you want to work with students, and why did you want to make sure that the space was open to them?
Although that is a good question, I ask myself that a lot, but that's really been my career, working with students. Before Milwaukee Public School, I was working at St. Charles, and that was a residential setting for youth that were on their way to either cleaning up their act or going to Wales. So I've always been in the career of working with students.
And it sounds like, too, like you want to work with students to make sure that they have a positive energy, they have a positive outlook. What was your motivating factor to work with students who were transitioning to better their life? What motivated you to make these spaces for students?
When I was growing up, I did drop out of the 9th grade. I did return and got my GED, but I feel like, you know, the teaching and the way kids are learning is still repetitive, and it's really not like they have a voice and are not being heard, and they don't feel comfortable in speaking in you know, in the school building about what's going on in their community. And me growing up feeling that, I want to come to them in a different way where they feel comfortable to share their stories or to ask me what can I do to help them get better. And I'm intervention. Let's intervene, you know, before the kids get off into drugs with the wrong crowd, running away from home, dropping out of school. So I want to reach them at an age where they feel that they could talk to adults. Because really, if they talk more to adults, and sometimes if we listen more, I think that would work better in their favor. So my background from really feeling like I wasn't being heard when I was young, and I was wilding out to wanting to get through to the kids.
Do you feel like music and hip-hop has healed or helped to heal students that you've been able to work with or who've walked through the space? And do you feel like hip-hop has healed you?
Yes, I do, because I'm a, you know, I was in the era of the 1970s when the message music first came out, you know, and really they didn't want us to get positive messages in music. And I feel that hip-hop has healed me. So that's why I use it to heal the younger generation. And I do believe music itself is soothing. It gets people comfortable. And yes, I do feel like hip-hop and music heals the kids. And it gives them that outlet to be creative, to write, to use critical thinking, and just use their strengths, build up on their strengths to feel like they can do what they need to do in this life.
For you, Antonio, with hip-hop, why was it so influential to you?
Well, in the 1980s, I want to say probably about 86, hip-hop was really motivating. And I think for me, it was a time where it really inspired me. The lyrics, the messages, that was back in the crack epidemic and drugs, and a lot of people were catching these cases and going to jail, and still they rose with these message music like they did in the 70s to inspire people and let people know what's going on, and also to give them a way to express what was going on in, with them and in their communities.
And do you feel like you hold that, the message and sentiment that those artists had in the 80s and 90s here in the space?
Most definitely, because they had rules, they had codes, they had the hip-hop declaration of peace. There were, you know, things to go by, and they followed those, okay? So now we're in an era where, you know, we're getting messages, but it might not be the best messages to inspire the youth to do the right thing. So I kind of just stay in that era that I can relate to.
What have been some positive moments that have been sticking out to you with the space open?
Well, not only have students come through, but there have been other hip-hop icons from Milwaukee, and they really like the space. They feel comfortable in the space. They see a lot of things, you know, that we could do in the space as far as getting together and building some positive outlets for Milwaukee. So this is really just the beginning. You know, I plan on doing a lot of other things here in my apartment and outside in the community, but overall, it's been really receptive. I am going to be continuing to collect for Milwaukee hip-hop artists, men and women, and working with them too, so we could also just get this positive thing to continue to flourish in the community. And I do believe that hip-hop is never going to stop, so that's where I'm going with it.
Do you have Milwaukee artists here in the collection? Are you looking into adding more to the 365 Museum?
Well, there's always more room for hip-hop, records, cassettes, always more room. Yes, I do have some Milwaukee artists. I have King Kamanzi, Jay Billa, The High Priest, Cuckoo Cal, to name a few. But I have a lot, an extensive collection too, and I'm still building that as I am getting and always asking for donations, especially Milwaukee hip-hop, because that's kind of rare to get.
And you mentioned this a little bit, but what's next for Antonia's 365 Hip Hop Museum?
Well, the museum is not just like for me. We don't have a hip hop museum in Milwaukee, so I'm looking forward to bringing the majority of people into this space so we can create a larger museum for positive interactions in Milwaukee. We need to recognize the hip hop folks. You know, when it's Black History Month, when it's Black Music Month, we'll have somewhere where we can go and we can celebrate that, as opposed to we have to go to Chicago or we have to go to wherever else we have to go to get this information, because there are other hip hop museums, but they're kind of far and few. So I just want to bring something special to Milwaukee that everybody can be a part of. Also, donations are always welcome, and input is always welcome as well, because, you know, I can't do it all by myself. I could use some input from the community. I'll say I'm going to be out in the community more, doing more pop-ups, working with the after-school programs, possibly even going into the colleges with displays and whatever, and just having these conversations so we can continue to remember, you know, the foundations of hip-hop, what started hip-hop, and regardless of what music we're listening to now, just remember to just try to stay positive with hip-hop.
Thank you so much, Antonia, for welcoming me into the space and talking about Antonia's 365 Hip Hop Museum. Thank you so much.
And thank you, Mallory. And you feel free to come back and bring some of your friends. And, you know, we can sit in the space and have a good time. We can drink some tea. We can drink some water. We can, you know, play some music. You're welcome to come back.
Antonia Anderson is the founder and CEO of Antonia's 365 Hip Hop Museum in Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. And in case you didn't know, you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast. If you'd like to take us on the go, or if you'd like to hear any of the segments on the show, you can search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Coming up, we're getting tips for tick season, how to protect yourself and recognize the signs of Lyme disease. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. It's summer, so many of us here in Wisconsin are spending a lot of time outside. And depending where you are in the state, being outside can come with the risk of tick bites and Lyme disease, a bacterial infection that's spread by deer ticks. These bugs can be as small as a poppy seed, making them difficult to notice on your body. To share some helpful tips on how to avoid tick bites and contracting Lyme disease, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski is joined by Dean Nardelli, Associate Professor of Health Science at UWM.
So we're going to start with the basics here. What is Lyme disease, and what does it do to humans? Lyme disease is a tick-borne infection. It's a bacterial infection that is carried by ticks that themselves are carried by various animals in the environment, especially wooded areas and high brush areas, high grass areas, things like that. And the disease comes about overall, not because of anything that the bacteria do in particular. They don't secrete any toxins or anything like that that we know of, but ultimately the disease comes about because of our own immune response to the microbes. So you get bitten by a tick that, if infected, would transmit the bacteria to you. And there are sort of three textbook stages. One very common symptom early on, days to weeks after infection, is a bullseye rash, which doesn't occur in everybody, but most people will develop sort of general flu-like symptoms. The second stage, which occurs about weeks to maybe months later, would be indicative of the microbe getting throughout the body to places with a lot of connective tissue. So you might develop aches, pains of the joints, the muscles, things like that, some neurological abnormalities, numbness, tingling of the extremities. And if still untreated, the later stage, which typically is about months to years afterwards, would be a furthering of these symptoms at the joints, you know, very profound pain and swelling of certain joints, very profound neurological abnormalities, memory, mood, sleep disorders, and things like that.
So we just went through kind of the laundry list of symptoms for adults. Does Lyme disease present itself differently in children?
The overall presentation is pretty similar in children, actually. The big thing to watch out for children, I would say, is that they may not have an awareness of the ticks. A lot of adults don't have awareness of the ticks, but generally the symptoms are roughly pretty similar overall.
So ticks carry this illness. And what is our tick radar, I guess, for lack of a better word, looking like in Wisconsin this year?
Sure. So not every tick that you would encounter has Borrelia burgdorferi, which is the bacteria that causes Lyme disease. They may have some other pathogens as well. Typically, the percent of ticks that are infected with Borrelia burgdorferi specifically tends to be greater in the western part of the state, the northwestern part of the state, and then kind of decreases as you go more east and southeast. But it's present just about everywhere. There are cases in, I believe, every county, and there have been over the years in the state. But the density tends to be higher, you know, toward La Crosse, something like that, Twin Cities. The Twin Cities area of Minnesota is kind of the epicenter of the upper Midwest endemic region.
Has the occurrence of Lyme disease increased in Wisconsin recently? Have you noticed an uptick?
I guess it depends on the data sets you look at. I would say over, you know, the course of 20 years, yeah. Yes, to answer your question, it's gone up. Very recently, though, maybe in the last couple of years, there has been sort of an analysis of various data sets where, in terms of a nationwide incidence, like the CDC would report on the order of like 30,000 cases or so throughout the whole country. And now current estimates put the incidence at almost 500,000. So from 30,000 to like 476,000, I think, are the estimates. I don't know if they've broken that down state by state specifically, but I would imagine that, you know, all of the states would have a lot more cases than have been reported.
So you mentioned not every tick is going to carry Lyme disease, but who is at most risk to develop Lyme disease if they are bitten?
I would say that anybody potentially, and that may be more of a factor of activity, outside activity, outdoor activity, being in the woods, not being aware of, you know, doing tick checks or things like that. But I believe that anybody could potentially become infected and develop Lyme disease, I should say, if they are bitten by a tick. But I think the driver is time spent outdoors, you know, rolling around with pets that might have ticks and things like that.
So what are the common treatments for Lyme disease? And we kind of already went into what happens if you go untreated, but what are the treatments and when ideally do you want to identify that you have developed this?
Ideally, the sooner the better. For treatment. So it's a bacterial infection that is treated with antibiotics. And if, say, let's say, for instance, you recognize you've been bit by a tick, or you start developing the symptoms, you see the bullseye rash, and you're like, yeah, I was camping or something like that, the provider would most likely give you antibiotics, maybe about a week, 2 weeks, I think, in duration. And that is usually sufficient to take care of the infection and halt any progression of disease, actually sort of truncate that sort of disease process. That's not always the case, though, because sometimes those early manifestations are confounding. You may not recognize the bullseye rash, and it may not be until you've started developing the more severe symptoms that you go in and get diagnosed. The treatment still would be antibiotics, depending on the severity of disease. It might be IV antibiotics for a little while, but the antibiotics would still be effective at killing the microbes. Now, the residual damage is another question, because if some damage is done, you can, you know, cease to be infected, but it could be a matter of time. You know, the disease doesn't resolve the next day or anything like that. So it can take some time to resolve. And in some people, some genetically predisposed individuals, that resolution of disease may take quite a long time and might require some other interventions, like anti-inflammatories or corticosteroids, or even getting some tissue of their joints removed. But the sooner the better for treatment.
When people are treated at these various stages, is there basically a 100% success rate that down the road their body will be clear of Lyme disease? Or does it depend, as you said, like depending on the residual symptoms and impacts?
Yeah, I think it depends on the residual. I'm always kind of hesitant to say 100% with anything biology. You know, most people, you get treated, and especially early on, it's typically not a problem afterwards. I think it's just sort of a matter of time. I think everybody's own immune responses are unique, and it's just kind of how your body is able to respond afterwards. If your starting point of treatment is one of these more at the point of more severe disease, you know, other factors going on individually just sort of may dictate the rate at which we recover. And there is, you know, the stats show about a 10% rate of those that are treated will still have those longer term persistent inflammatory responses, especially in the joints. So some of it's genetics, some of it's just a constellation of our unique characteristics that drive recovery.
Your research involves looking into the ways Lyme disease manifests in the human body, particularly with arthritis as a frequent occurrence. So can you touch upon your work a little bit and some of the highlights about what you've learned?
Sure. Well, I don't do human research. I use an animal model of arthritis that we hope can inform us about how humans respond. So my research sort of dovetails from this concept that we have our own unique properties that dictate, you know, the degree to which we mount these inflammatory responses. Some people may have a particularly strong response to Borrelia burgdorferi, and in turn may have a more pronounced disease, and some may have a less pronounced inflammatory response and less pronounced disease. We focus on a particular type of T cell in the body called regulatory T cells that do just that. They regulate the immune response. They're sort of this central key cell that governs how our entire immune response reacts. And we've shown that in our experimental work, these regulatory T cells are indeed critical factors for recovery, even preventing disease. The model that we use is an animal model where the animals actually don't develop Lyme arthritis. But if we take those cells away, then they do. So they act, we think they act as sort of a gatekeeper, and ultimately something that really, you know, if you have more of these cells, maybe you're less prone to developing the severe disease, or maybe can recover quickly. If they're more active cells, sort of more robust in their activity, that can sort of dictate outcomes as well.
So given that Wisconsin is a hotspot for ticks, what are the best ways we can prevent getting a tick bite in the first place that could lead to Lyme disease?
Sure. The best way, I want to say stay indoors, but that's not ever going to happen. Be aware. So these ticks live in wooded areas. They live in areas of, you know, where there's a lot of brush or tall grass. So maintaining property is really important. If you're in the woods going camping, the best way to prevent is to have as much of your skin covered as possible, which I realize may not be the most realistic thing in the summer, or in some cases may not be the most fashionable. But if you're talking about wanting to not get bitten by a tick, you know, wear a hat, long sleeve shirts, pants, you know, instead of shorts. You know, a lot of the literature will say tuck your pants into your socks, prevent, you know, all of that. Insect repellent containing DEET, that's something that can repel the ticks away. You know, and of course, that's not always realistic. So whether you're outdoors taking those precautions or not, it's always good to do very thorough tick checks on yourself, on your kids, you know, looking literally everywhere on the body, through the hair, you name it. And it does take a little while for the ticks to actually transmit the bacteria. So they have to be attached for, you know, the literature varies in how long, but, you know, on the order of maybe like a day and a half to 2 days. So if you do find a tick on you, it could be okay. It may not be something that is an emergency, but you do want to make sure that you take the tick off properly. And you can find ways to do this online. Basically, you take a tweezers as close to the skin and just kind of work it out slowly. You know, don't flick it off or burn it or anything like that. And then also you can treat fabrics, tents, clothing, things like that with, you know, other repellents as well to prevent the ticks from even getting on, and yeah, making sure that you're safe.
All good tips to keep in mind as we start enjoying the summertime and getting outside more. So Dean, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much, Audrey.
Dean Nardelli is an associate professor of health science at UW-Milwaukee, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll look at parking in downtown Milwaukee and learn why lots make up so much of the city's infrastructure. All of that is tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM. Milwaukee's NPR.